First, though, we previewed it last night, but the much-anticipated announcement of a major investment by Honda to build batteries and assemble electric vehicles in southern Ontario was made official today. Sam Fiorani is Vice President, Global Vehicle Forecasting with Auto Forecast Solutions. He's here to help us wade through the details. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So for you, what are some of the main highlights of this announcement today?
This investment allows Honda to build the electric vehicles from the ground up. It allows Canada to become a strong part of the supply chain globally for electric vehicles, and utilizing all that Canada has to offer for electric vehicles, and to help Canada become a player on the world stage for electric vehicles.
And the sheer scale of it does seem certainly big and impressive. Is it $15 billion? Is that where the final number comes in terms of the investment?
That's the number they gave us, that this is more money than Honda has invested in Canada since they started 40 years ago.
Okay. And it's, I think it's four plants is what they announced today. So in practical terms, if you can, you know, walk us out into, I guess they're not too distant future. Is it 2028 that they hope to have everything up and running?
By 2028, Honda will start building electric vehicles in Alliston. The whole plan includes a battery factory, which will also be built in Alliston, and two plants in other parts of Ontario supplying cathodes and battery separators. So this provides a growing supply chain of all parts of the whole plan of electric vehicles from the ground up, from minerals all the way up to the finished product.
And that's interesting because a lot of times, you know, and it pick the industry, but sometimes, you know, the final assembly will take place in a certain jurisdiction or a certain country, but the parts or the supplies or the fuel in this case would be brought in from somewhere else. But this is all encompassing. There'll be mining adventures in Ontario and Quebec to extract the minerals needed for the batteries. Where is this in terms of, I'm not sure if you can make a comparison, but in terms of some of the investments that Honda or Volkswagen or other companies have been made in other countries around the world, where does Canada stack up and this announcement, I guess, in particular in Ontario?
Well, all the car companies are looking for a way to make these vehicles profitably and efficiently. And the problem they're having everywhere is making sure they have all the components locally. It's expensive to haul a battery from one place to another, from where you assemble it to put it where you put it into the vehicle. So this allows Honda to build the battery packs locally and then ship them over to the assembly plant, which won't be too far away. Unlike some plants around the world where battery packs may have to travel tens or twenties of miles, this is relatively close. Battery packs are heavy, and it costs a lot of money to move them. But this encompasses from the mining.
Oh, I think we're just having a little bit of trouble with the connection. Are you still there, Sam?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're kind of moving in and out here of reception. I'm not sure if you're on the move or we just have a bad connection. Can you hear me all right? No way. Okay, I think we're going to just retry and try and remake that connection with Sam Fiorani. Sam is the Vice President, Global Vehicle Forecasting. He's with Auto Forecast Solutions. And if you had just joined us, we did preview it to an extent last night. Of course, last night we were just, there was a certain amount of speculation involved, but Global News reporters had pretty much tracked down the story that there was going to be this major announcement today involving Honda, involving the federal government, also involving, of course, the government of Ontario to set up shop in southern Ontario to build batteries and to assemble electric vehicles. I think we've got reestablished our connection with Sam. Sam, when we get to full capacity here, do we have any idea how many vehicles these plants will be producing in southern Ontario, electric vehicles?
Honda wants to build 240,000 a year. That's a considerable size for an electric vehicle plant. It's a considerable size for any plant, but this will provide a number of vehicles for when the demand grows to about 2028. We should have demand for 250,000 vehicles by then.
Okay, so you think that what they're producing will be consumed by the demand that will be built up by then. Is there any comparison that we can make, for example, if there was a like-sized conventional car plant and how many cars would be produced with internal combustion engines, or is it difficult to do that? Are we comparing apples to oranges here?
Well, I don't have a size on the plant itself. However, the Alliston plant has been building, has had a capacity of 400,000 units total for a number of years. So this was just part of that plant that was previously building Civics.
Okay. And what are we looking at in terms of jobs? What are we forecasting here?
In the announcement, Honda announced that they would add 1,000 new jobs, but it's also securing a lot of jobs that are at Alliston now. And a number of jobs. This is just 1,000 direct jobs. The supply chain will build up and you'll have, you know, tens of thousands of more jobs on down the line.
Okay. And I also was curious, and we just touched on this briefly when we were previewing this announcement yesterday, and it comes down to where we are with demand for electric vehicles. And we know there are a lot of issues out there. There are issues with infrastructure, which, you know, when we talk infrastructure, a lot of times we're simply talking about charging stations, whether that be, you know, stations on the side of the highway, stations outside restaurants, stations that may need to be built for apartment buildings and condo complexes and all those sorts of things. We also have an added cost for a lot of these electric vehicles that some people aren't quite ready or able to make that leap. And so sometimes we see surveys where it seems to indicate that the demand and the want is not quite there for electric vehicles yet, that is starting to wane a little bit. And yet we look at sales figures and it shows continued growth for electric vehicles. So with what you do for a living, where are you seeing the appetite in Canada right now for electric vehicles, and where do you see us heading here? Is it going to grow by leaps and bounds, or is it going to be a gradual climb, do you think?
We're going to see a steady growth when the growth picks up again. But right now we're at a stage in between early adopters and regular car buyers. So the early adopters were ready to spend money and be on the first wave, but it's going to take the regular car buyers, the later car buyers, to actually take this to the next level and compete it directly with internal combustion engine vehicles. But in order to do that, we're going to need better infrastructure. We're going to need better education, because buyers need to know that these vehicles can take care of all their needs. And that's one of the fears that a lot of buyers have, is that this, I can't go everywhere. I'll get stuck somewhere. And understanding how an electric vehicle works will do a lot of that to allay their fears and allow them to make the leap into electric vehicles. But we need infrastructure in condos and in apartment buildings, across highways, in stores. So there's going to be a lot of infrastructure built to help this out. And it's going to take a lot of things coming together in order to get us to the next level of car sales. But it will take off. But we're going to see a couple of years here where the growth doesn't seem to be as sharp as it was a couple of years ago.
And it seems, and maybe this is just anecdotal, and maybe this is just because, you know, announcements when it comes to infrastructure are not as sexy and don't catch people's attention, but it seems that we're hearing more about investments into things like we saw today in Ontario. We're going to build battery plants. We're going to build electric vehicle assembly plants. We're doing that in Ontario. We're doing it in Quebec. But we don't seem to be hearing as much about progress for that infrastructure. Is the car manufacturing outpacing the infrastructure? And if so, how do we play catch up here, or can we play catch up over a short period of time?
Manufacturing is outpacing the demand at the moment, but we're going to see demand pick up again, and we're going to need all this supply to fill that. The problem we're seeing is that you need this investment for the future of the auto industry, to keep the jobs, to keep the whole industry moving forward. We're going to need investment in electric vehicles. If this were a brand new internal combustion vehicle plant, those jobs would be at risk in 5 or 10 years. But as an electric vehicle plant and battery plant, that gives the region life for the next 20 or 30 years. So it's ensuring jobs. If not tomorrow, in 5 years, in 10 years, these jobs will be secure and ready to go for another decade or more.
All right. Terrific. Well, Sam, thanks for your insight tonight. A big announcement today. It impacts a lot of people and it will create a lot of jobs. And it seems to be the way of the world. There is that debate, of course. And some of it depends on where you are. And some of it is political, what your beliefs are. But certainly electric vehicles are here to stay. It's just a matter of when they take over. And we'll see where that leads us here over the next few years. Thanks for your time tonight. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're talking about the future of the social media app TikTok, which seems to be, could be, maybe is in jeopardy in the United States. The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly approved a bill. The president has signed that same bill. That would mean it would ban TikTok unless its Chinese owners sell the platform within 9 months. We're joined to discuss this by Karim Bardizi from Democracy Exchange, executive director as well, the DS at Toronto Metropolitan University. Karim, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Now, is it important that we make that distinction that the U.S. isn't voting to ban TikTok, but rather to force its Chinese ownership to divest? Or is that kind of a distinction without a difference? What do you make of it?
Well, there is a possible world in which that could happen. It could be a divestment, a sale instead of a ban or some other agreement. So I think it's an important distinction just because it sets out a few different paths. And it's also going to be probably subject to litigation and probably all the way up to the Supreme Court. So there's a variety of ways this could go.
And what do you make of it? On its face, is it a good thing? I mean, the reasons that people would put forth, now there are some young people are spending too much time on social media. That's one argument that people make. And then there's the argument that U.S. legislature seem to be making, which is that they're concerned and they don't have confidence that the Chinese government couldn't just step in at some point and force ByteDance, which is the owner of TikTok, to hand over private personal data and information.
Yeah, and there's lots of evidence that specific concern about Chinese government influence over the company is correct. The Chinese government has passed a law which gives it the ability to access data from companies in which it has a specific interest, and ByteDance is one of those data companies that is covered by the law. So Chinese government is able to do this. It's able to call on the data at any time, and it's also obviously hard for us to know what other kinds of forms of information might be being passed up to the Chinese authorities without us officially knowing that it's happening. There's another trend and phenomenon, which is that Chinese workers are increasingly involved in the company. ByteDance is the parent company. TikTok is the Singapore-based affiliate. But there's lots of evidence that there's increased numbers of Chinese workers who are working at the company, and some evidence in the past that some of the data was already being passed over into China and to the Chinese government.
So is this move, in your mind, is it warranted? Is it welcomed?
Well, I think it's an important thing to consider. It's a pretty dramatic move by the U.S. government or, U.S. legislators and signed into law by President Biden. We've never seen this with a social media platform or broadcast platform like this before. The United States has the vaunted First Amendment, which is supposed to protect all kinds of communication, including this kind of communication. So it's a real indication of how much of an interest it is. We at the Dais and some of our research suggest that indeed there is a lot of concern around the national security elements of this. We also have a concern about what you mentioned at the introduction, that it's a platform with an especially powerful algorithm, which seems to be playing a special part in distracting young people. But it's also got a lot of positive attributes. It enables a whole set of content creators. It is helping people communicate with each other. So it's not simple. We would prefer that this kind of technology had connections to the kinds of protections and authorities that exist in Canada and the U.S., where you have companies that have boards that are subject to Canadian and U.S. laws, that wouldn't have the government's right to just reach in and take in any data possible.
And is this not the challenge with it, with any of the, I mean, we've seen CEOs of Meta, which is Facebook, and you know, pretty much all of the main, you know, Twitter, which is X now, all of the main companies up before congressional hearings, getting grilled on their practices, getting grilled on not only free speech, but privacy and all these sorts of things. But it seems late. It seems, I mean, we wait until there are hundreds of millions of people using these applications. And for some people, it becomes almost central to their personality. And we'll get in maybe later into people who are making money. In some cases, it's their full-time job to be on these platforms. But then we come in and say, okay, there's, you know, 170 million people in the United States that are using TikTok in one form or another, either actively or somewhat passively. And now we're going to do something about controlling access to it or controlling ownership of it. It seems like we're late to the party on a lot of these new technologies.
Totally, years late. So in the case of ByteDance and TikTok, and its predecessor app, Musical.ly, you know, this app has been around for quite a while in social media terms, around 7-8 years. This Chinese law is 5 years old, and only now are we turning our attention to this kind of move. You mentioned Meta and Google and Twitter and X and others. So we've been late to kind of attending to social media regulating the most pernicious aspects of those platforms, the capabilities they have for spreading misinformation and hate. And that kind of thing has the potential to replicate itself with the world of generative AI, generative mm-hmm. artificial intelligence technologies, which can are scaling even faster than the older social media platforms are. And a lot of people are saying, well, with generative AI, we can't make the same mistake. We can't wait as long. And then you have the added dimension of generative AI can become superpowered on social media platforms. and so that is a potentially very dangerous combination. It's an exciting combination, but it's also a dangerous combination. So yeah, I think in Canada, definitely policymakers are starting to wake up to this. We have both an Online Harms Act and an Artificial Intelligence and Data Act, which are before the House of Commons right now. And as you mentioned, the TikTok ban, which is now passed the U.S. Senate.
And it seems from from the public standpoint, one of the challenges when you are late to the party and you're jumping in, when these things are already way down the road and established and have millions, if not hundreds of millions of users, is now rather than governments looking like they're just in tune with what's right and what's wrong and trying to protect people, trying to protect their privacy, trying to protect from bullying or from other heinous acts that can be carried out through some of these platforms. Instead of that, which would probably be easy to explain and grasp and understand if we were doing it in the early stages, it now seems like if you're an active TikTok user, and even if you're just a fan of scrolling through the TikTok videos, the government is taking something away that we've become used to. And so it becomes a much more difficult sell, I would think.
Exactly. We've been tracking at the dais. We've been tracking for 5 years now, Canadians' appetite for regulation of social media in particular. And over the 5 years, they've become increasingly activist. They've been increasingly desiring more regulation. And so that, in part, is an indication of inaction by government. They see these technologies and they become more worried. We've seen our surveys also ask if social media companies, we ask a range of companies whether they can be trusted to work in the best interest of the public. And some of these companies have fallen quite a bit in the last few years. You know, companies like Meta and now TikTok are trusted less than some of the telecom giants and some of the oil and gas giants and some of the most well-known Canadian companies. We also surveyed whether TikTok should be banned in Canada. We've just got some very new information in our poll that says that 34% of Canadians think it should be banned completely, and 24% think it should be banned for minors under the age of 18. Very new information that we've just gotten out from a survey.
So yeah, well, that's pretty significant.
And it's something that Canadian policymakers are going to have to face if this ban ends up taking effect. Now, I'm actually skeptical that it'll actually the ban will actually succeed. But if it does, there'll be really strong momentum for Canadians to have to decide the same. It would be difficult for Canada to be offside with the U.S. on this one.
Right. And it would be difficult to imagine there wouldn't be court challenges to this. And even if those court challenges fail on behalf of ByteDance and TikTok, you would think a much more logical solution from an ownership standpoint would be to activate a sale, which is what Congress has wanted, and put it in the hands of somebody else. You wouldn't think they would just kind of roll it up with that many users and that many billions of dollars at stake and walk away.
No, exactly. And there's another thing just to keep in mind with this. These technologies, as powerful as they are, and in TikTok, ByteDance's case, an especially powerful algorithm, the other social media companies are trying desperately to copy in various ways. Meta in particular is well known for creating products that rip off and copy the best innovations of other companies, not necessarily in an illegal way, but in a way that has them pursuing market share. They've done that with Threads. Meta's done that with Threads as a competitor to X, as an example.
So they look at the company that might be about to be banned and say, you know what, we should do more of that.
Yeah, and that's the other thing just to keep in mind. The ban isn't going to make some of the fundamental issues go away. It might alleviate some of the concerns about national security, but some of the deeper concerns that people have with social media platforms are not going to go away with a prospective TikTok ban. I just want to say one other thing too. You know, the United States is the home of the First Amendment, and it's an unusual intervention here that the Congress has decided to move so aggressively against one company. So, you know, the company has already responded in the video today, saying that they are going to fight, so they don't intend on selling. So stay tuned for a court battle, and they're going to have some strong arguments, not just for themselves as a company, but they're going to mobilize their users, their creators, to tell very compelling stories that this is a violation of free expression rights.
And I think you're absolutely right about the politics of this. I mean, I don't know that... in terms of, it doesn't seem like we've ever been more divided, whether it's in Canada or in the United States. There just seems to be this real animosity. I mean, in the States, Republicans and Democrats don't seem to reach common ground on really anything. Taxation, healthcare, there's big disputes about foreign aid. And yet, TikTok seems to be the one thing that they're all on the same page with. Do you find that surprising?
Yeah, and it's a combination actually of two things, where two of the only issues, I'm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the year, so I get a different perspective on this. Two of the only issues the Republicans and Democrats are agreeing on these days, in a way that creates majorities or supermajorities, are A, China is a threat, and B, the social media platforms have too much power.
And this is both of them.
Those two issues are combined in this issue. Again, it's a bit of a reverse outcome because Meta, Google, even Apple and others are watching closely for opportunities to copy these. So it's not like the fundamental thing is going away. But this is that helps explain why this has happened in this case.
I'm curious, and I don't know how much detail you want to go into on the new surveys that you conducted that showed a sizable, I guess it would be a majority if you count the number of people that think it should be banned outright. We're talking about TikTok and those who think it should be made unavailable to those under 18. But it's a fairly high percentage of Canadians that feel that way. Do you think it's a generational thing? Like what were the ages of the people that you surveyed? Is this going to be perceived as, you know, old people taking away the young people's fun?
So Sid, this is so hot off the presses. We actually don't have that. I asked for the age breakdown. We don't have that yet for this. This is just new data back from the field in the last week or so from Canadians. So we're still crunching some of the numbers. I can tell you that broadly, TikTok is a very attractive source of information and news for younger Canadians. But even younger Canadians have that mistrust. We have the survey data from last year and the year before showed a significant decline in the trust for TikTok. This is the first time we asked about a divestment in this recent survey, but in previous surveys we've asked about trust in TikTok, and there was a significant decline between 2021 and 2023 in trust for TikTok. I don't think that has much to do with China. I think that has more to do with this perception that it's an addictive platform that might be serving up other forms of misinformation. That wasn't, incidentally, one of the things that the people promoting the ban were able to use. Some people who promoted the ban were promoting it because they said the algorithm fed up too much pro-Palestinian rhetoric in the wake of the October 7th attacks and subsequent war.
Right.
Other people might say, oh, it's because it's feeding up too much self-harm narratives for young people. Some people might are opposed to TikTok because it might be feeding up too much pro-LGBTQ propaganda. Some people might think it's serving up too much anti-LGBTQ propaganda. So yeah. People can really read their own biases and preferences into this and come to the same conclusion.
We're speaking with Karim Bardizi of the Toronto Metropolitan University, talking about TikTok and the prospect of it either being banned or perhaps a forced sale to get it out of Chinese ownership. That is the wish of, and it's the subject of legislation that has been passed by the United States Congress. And Karim, before the break, I just kind of threw something out there, and I don't know if we can wrap our head around this, but and I'm sure it's been there from the beginning of the debate, but I just kind of glommed onto it a few days ago. There was a discussion about potential job loss if TikTok is forced to disband and to go away. Do we have any stats, or do we know how many people, we're talking content creators here, we're not talking about, you know, the programmers or the IT people that will work for the company yeah. itself, but those who either in whole or in part now count on a platform like TikTok for their livelihood?
Yeah, I haven't seen good Canadian data on this. The company does have a history of having creator funds. So there's basically, for people who are on the platform, there's two main ways you can make money off it. You can be one of these people who makes money directly from the revenues from very highly viewed material if you're part of some sort of business arrangement with the company, which is typically through creator funds, other forms of revenue sharing, which are very opaque. You know, these companies aren't, you know, they aren't giving commissions in a very standard way. They've got these disparate users. They have access to way more data than the people who are making content on the platform. That's one way to make money. And then the other way to make money is to use what you're doing on TikTok to drive more of your sales through other means. So, you know, you have a product you're selling in the real world or the virtual world. People are perhaps more likely to purchase your product or service if you're doing a good job on TikTok. So those are the two main ways to make money. And it's hard. We don't have a lot of great information around that. And I'll also just say quickly that, you know, there's the chance if the ban happens, people will migrate to other platforms. They might be better at using some platforms than others. They might not be as good at it, but the prospect of making money off other platforms is still there.
Mm-hmm. And if you're going to venture a guess, and I know we just don't like to guess about things of this kind of import, but how do you see this thing, or how would you think it might play out here over the next several months, specifically when we're talking about TikTok?
Yeah, so it's going to be it's going to get interesting because TikTok is just again today their CEO said we're going to fight this, and they're going to you know, they haven't been as responsive as they could have been. You know, I just read that they spent about $7 million US on lobbying on this bill. This is a company with tens of billions of dollars of profit every year, eclipsing $100 billion in US revenue. So they probably could have spent a bit more to head this situation off. Now they're alert, and they're going to, I think, muster not only their own resources, but that of the creators, the ones that, as you said, might fear that their livelihood is at stake. And they're going to make some pretty strong arguments around freedom of speech. They're probably going to have to thread the needle of the people who are on the platform, but know it's not necessarily good for them. And that was one. That's really one. Very strong, interesting part that we have to our research. Even the people who are say that these platforms are negative or they don't have trust in them, they're often using the platforms at the same time as they're saying that these platforms are harmful. So it's an interesting kind of needle to thread with the public, the general public who is concerned. As I said, 58% of Canadians think it should be banned outright or banned for people under 18. And yet, you know, people are using this platform. including young people themselves. They have a more sophisticated view of this, I think, than sometimes people give them credit for. They know that sometimes that this product is distracting, is serving them up the sugar rather than the broccoli in their online lives.
Right, and it will be interesting to see where it goes. We have not heard the last of it. There will be court challenges, and there will be some very public debates, I'm sure. Kareem, thanks for your time tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Finn.
We're joined by Reed Wilkins, who is the host of Oilers Hockey on 630 CHED in Edmonton. We've been checking in various Canadian NHL cities. We've got, four Canadian teams that made the NHL playoffs this year, all with really good regular seasons. Not a case of teams needing to win their last four games and sneak in on the last day. I mean, these are teams, the Oilers, I guess, got off to a very slow start at the start of the season, but since then they've been gangbusters. Vancouver came out of the gates flying and never looked back. Winnipeg's had a great season. Toronto has been there in the regular season for a few years now, still looking to kind of make some waves when it comes to the Stanley Cup playoffs. But we thought we'd check in Edmonton today. We'll get a feel for the city itself. I mean, we'll talk a little bit of hockey. We'll talk a little bit of, goals and assists and power plays and all those things that the hardcores like to talk about at this time of year. But some of the excitement generated across the country is simply the noise levels inside the buildings and the watch parties outside the buildings. In some cases, filling arenas while their team is on the road, just for that community that sports really is and how it brings people together, and particularly for the Stanley Cup playoffs. So Reed, thanks for coming on the program and spending some of what I guess is your off night from broadcasting Oilers games. So we appreciate you joining us tonight.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you, Sid. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the Oilers, and I'm sure you must have been talking about this on your show and your station today on 630 CHED in Edmonton. What do you think of when you think of Bob Cole and the legacy of Bob Cole?
Wow. I think of almost every significant hockey moment I watched between the ages of about 6 and 34, maybe 35. that's what I think of. I think of... Certainly, as someone who grew up in the 80s, I think of him calling Glenn Anderson's goal to clinch it in 87. I think of him calling Lanny McDonald's goal to help Calgary win in 89. I think of him calling Patrick Waugh and the Canadiens up, going on that incredible run in 93 and beating the Kings in the final, and John LeClair's two overtime goals and Eric Desjardins' goal. And then obviously the Olympics in 02. He just the soundtrack for big hockey moments for decades in Canada. And the one thing I said today, the great play-by-play voices, the ones who do the big events or tournaments and the nationally or internationally televised games, they get to be more famous than some of the players who participated in those games, because their voice is on it. And when you go back and watch the highlight, it's his call that you remember.
Right. And I mentioned we're going to be talking to Chris Cuthbert coming up, the golden goal, those moments, those highlight sports moments that we all sort of gravitate to. And we're talking, some people are hardcore sports fans, some are casual fans, but there's those moments. And the voice of Bob Cole, well, here's one that I always sort of gravitate to when I'm thinking of Bob Cole.
Here's Lemieux, the center, penalty coming up. Look at Lemieux! Oh my heavens! What a goal! What a move! Lemieux!
I mean, I could just, as I listen to it, I can see Lemieux going basically through that defense and then almost over top of the goalie. It was a wonderful goal, but made even better when you listen to the call from a guy like Bob Cole.
And I think, Sid, what is captured there is certainly as a broadcaster and especially as a play-by-play voice, you have to describe what is happening. But then there are moments where you just have to put yourself on the couch or on the bar stool next to the people watching the game and just kind of say, holy crap, did you see that? which is what he's saying there. One thing I got onto today, we were talking about other great calls in other sports, and I said Vern Lundquist, when Tiger made that miraculous chip at the Masters on the 16th hole in 05, he said, oh my goodness, as the ball's going closer to the hole. And then when the ball goes in, he goes, oh wow, because that's what everybody else is saying.
Yes.
So you have to have the ability to know when you have to go a little deeper for the audience. And then you have to have that ability that I think Bob Cole really had when you're just communicating. He could do it through his cadence and his tone of voice and the way he would build, that you just had to kind of assure people watching on TV, hey, you think it's exciting on TV? Yeah, trust me, it's exciting. Like, you need to keep paying attention.
And I often wonder if it's more difficult to build a legacy like Bob Cole today than it was when he was in his heyday. Now, I mean, there's social media, there's the internet, so it's easier to get out there, but it's also easier to be overexposed, and there's so many people out there that it's easier, I think, to get lost in the shuffle. And where I'm going with this is when Bob Cole burst onto the scene, you know, hockey, you know, your home team wasn't on television every second night. You know, you were sitting there waiting for Saturday night to come along for that one game you might get, particularly if you're in some rural parts of Canada. And, you know, Bob Cole was as much a part of that experience as the two teams that were going to be playing that night. There was no such thing as overexposure when you were on the air for 3 hours a week.
Yeah, and I think you're right that now every game is televised. And plus now you can go on Twitter or Instagram or YouTube and get a compilation of all the different calls, right? And some, even in hockey now, some of the big games and big goals are called in other languages. So say there's a goal in the Stanley Cup final. Well, the next morning you could probably find a 2-minute edit on YouTube of Chris Cuthbert's call, of who's ever calling the game on ESPN or TNT, their call of the Spanish language call of a Punjabi call, because, you know, Hockey Night in Canada is in other languages as well. And you get all those voices, right? As opposed to you're right. It used to be it's Bob Cole and he's doing a game a week, or in the playoffs, you know, maybe a game every second night. So you're right. You wonder if you think of, I don't quite remember Danny Galvin, but then certainly Hewitt before him, like, are those kind of the, I guess you need a fourth person for Mount Rushmore, but are they kind of the Mount Rushmore of Canadian hockey commentators, because they had the whole stage. I mean, they earned it and they were great at it, but they kind of had the whole stage almost to themselves.
Our guest is Reed Wilkins. He's the host of Oilers Hockey on 630 CHED in Edmonton, where the hometown Oilers are currently tied at a game apiece with the Los Angeles Kings in their opening round series of the Stanley Cup playoffs. And Reed, I'm curious, you know, we were talking to Paul Edmonds out of Winnipeg yesterday, and just talking mostly about the atmosphere in the arena, outside the arena, that really seems to be a touch point for a lot of people this time of year. What's it been like in your hometown in Edmonton?
Oh, man. I mean, the crowd is awesome. I mean, Oilers fans are so passionate and just so loud. And I'll start this story, actually, Sid, by going back several years. And in 2017, the Oilers were finally in the playoffs for the first time after missing for 10 years in a row. And I was doing our face-off show in the, you know, the media level at Rogers Place. Mm-hmm. And it was probably 30 minutes before the warm-up. And there was a Let's Go Oilers chant, like a loud one. And I mean, the arena's nowhere near full. And people were just so excited. And you heard it again this year. You see how they've kept the tradition of the whole crowd singing part of the Canadian anthem alive since Paul Laurio did that. I mean, almost 20 years ago now. And then, I mean, the inside the arena is one thing, but I mean, now that we're able to fully take advantage, the area around the arena is called Ice District. So across the street from the ice trick from Rogers Place, if you go south, there's that huge gathering, and that's the one that's often shown on TV. That's called the Moss Pit, in honor of Joey Moss. And that's where they have kind of that big high angle shot of all the people gathering to watch. And then to the east of the arena, across the street that way, there's another larger outdoor gathering space. And then for the road games, and it's going to be this way on Friday and Sunday, the arena is sold out, or close to sold out, with people paying $5 to watch the game on the Jumbotron. So, you know, it's you come to the game and you're in the arena, or you still go downtown and you watch the game somewhere else with a large crowd of people. It's just so intense. People rally around it. And like Sid, I mean, you and I work together, and you used to do the job that I do. I mean, we talk about it every day. So sometimes, you know, you feel like, okay, that's part of my job, and I talk about it a lot. But then when I'm out in public, or, you know, meeting other people, or talking to friends or you know, acquaintances I don't see that often, you do realize everybody is pulled into it to some extent. And I have people in my life, Sid, that aren't sports fans, that probably wouldn't watch a game, and you know, that don't get sports, but they still know how the team is doing. Like you can't just not know. You can't just totally be detached from it. You know, like people who will still say to me, yeah, weren't they doing really bad? Now they're doing good. Yeah, that's pretty much what happened. Or
that is a perfect summation of your Oilers season right there, I think.
Yeah, but
they were doing bad, now they're doing good.
Yeah, but the people know they can't just totally detach from it. And then just a couple other quick stories, if there's time. I'll flash back to 2017 again. I have a cousin who's a little older than me who, you know, knows hockey, knows the team, like might casually watch a game or, you know, if it's on, but she's never really thought sports was a big deal, kind of didn't understand, you know, why would you spend $100-$200 to go to a game? And then in 2017, the playoffs started. She says, where do I get one of those orange shirts? She's like, everybody at work's got an orange shirt. And because, you know, they kind of rolled out orange as the big color for the Oilers that year. And she, you just, to fit in and to talk to people, you got to know what's going on. And then the best story, another friend of mine didn't watch games, like, of course, knew there was a team, knew who McDavid was, but didn't watch games, kind of didn't get it. Started watching the odd game. Starts asking me the odd question. Starts texting me during a game. Okay, why was that a penalty? Why'd they blow the whistle? Okay. And, you know, so this goes on for 3 or 4 years. And then a couple of years ago, you know, we're out for a pint, and she says to me, so there's a game tomorrow, yeah? I said, yeah. Well, she's like, okay, when do you work? I'm like, oh. And then she goes, so what are we going to do about the third line? And I'm like, I nearly fell out of my chair, Sid. Like, 4 or 5 years earlier, she wouldn't have known what the blue line was. And now she's asking a specific question about who's going to take faceoffs, you know, when Leon's on the too tired to do it. Like, so it's just, it's amazing to see people get pulled into it, and it's just an endless passion for the team in this city.
Yeah, it does seem to be a much bigger tent that includes a lot more people when a team has success, and it doesn't really matter what the market is, and particularly I would think in the Canadian markets, but yeah, you're right. It kind of pulls in casual fans and fans that you never thought would be as excited as they end up being. I was watching the Oilers game on television. I'm not sure if it was game one or game two, but they were interviewing somebody before the game who was painted head to toe in Oilers colors. And then there's a woman behind the Oilers bench that gets on television quite a bit. She's dressed in all, I'm assuming, trying to look maybe like the Stanley Cup, all dressed in silver, face paint, tassels, the whole thing. Have you seen her?
I have seen her. I've never seen her in person, but I have seen her. We do our pre and post game shows in a large sports bar called Studio 99. And we have seen people decked out in paint, you know, like whatever. But I haven't met the Stanley Cup woman. But I mean, it's part of going to a game too. Is it's a night out, right? Like it's you're not at work. You're cheering on your team, and yeah, maybe you're pulling something out of the closet or making something to show your passion for the team. But it's I've seen the Stanley Cup outfit. Hopefully she can pose next to the real one in about 7 weeks. I think that would be the dream here.
All right. I do have to ask you at least one or two questions just about hockey since you've been so gracious with your time. So last night's game didn't go the Oilers' way. Well, one thing I think kind of went the Oilers' way.
Holloway forces a turnover. CeCe rifles a pass to Janmark that's tipped to Holloway. Shoots and scores. Dylan Holloway. Holloway off the rock, shoots and scores. Dylan Holloway's quick release. It struck again, and this game is tied at 4. The rookie Dylan Holloway continues to light it up.
So that's Jack Michaels, the play-by-play voice of the Edmonton Oilers on 630 CHED and the Oilers Radio Network. Dylan Holloway there, a couple of goals, his first two playoff goals. But it ultimately didn't go the Oilers' way. They lost in overtime. How do you see the rest of this series playing out? I know you're great at predicting these things.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I still think the Oilers are the better team. I don't know if LA can play much better than they did last night. I think the Oilers can play significantly better than they did last night. I know the margins are close, but you know, if you look at game one, Edmonton dictated it for the first 30 minutes of the game, and LA didn't have much say in it. So, you know, LA responded. Now it's the Oilers' chance to respond. You played the Holloway clips. I mean, maybe his best game in the NHL to this point, playoffs or otherwise. And I wonder if he gets a look perhaps on Draisaitl's line. Draisaitl, Fogle, and Nugent Hopkins didn't have a great game yesterday. Holloway can play with pace. He's got decent size, and now we've seen that he can have some confidence when he lets that shot go. So to me, that's one lineup change. It's probably the same lineup, but maybe a tweak to the lines there with Holloway getting a chance to play more.
Now, some people I know put a lot of stock in advantages for home teams, whether that's line changes, line matching, that sort of thing. Do you think the fact that these next two games are going to be in Los Angeles, will that play a factor here, do you think?
I think it does a little bit. I don't think it does too much because I think both teams are comfortable with the matchups. You know, like I think that it'll probably be the bottom six lines against each other and, Deneau against McDavid and Kopitar against Draisaitl, and Draisaitl's line is just going to have to do a better job than they did.
Right. Reed Wilkins, thank you, and have fun tomorrow night when you're broadcasting game three of the Edmonton Oilers and the Los Angeles Kings. We appreciate your time tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sid.
We continue here talking about the legacy of Bob Cole, and for that now we're joined by Chris Cuthbert. Chris is, of course, lead play-by-play voice of Hockey Night in Canada and Rogers Sportsnet, longtime colleague and friend of Bob Cole. Chris, first of all, welcome to the program. And I'm wondering if you could maybe just take us back a bit in time. You're there. You're a young broadcaster. You're starting your career. What was it like to meet and really become a colleague of the great Bob Cole?
Well, he was not a huge man, but larger than life. Obviously, that voice and everything that went with it. I don't know if a lot of people know Bob was an athlete in his day as well. He represented Newfoundland in curling at the Brier a couple of times. He was also he had the big forearms, and I think Bob was probably a pretty tough guy in his day, and I won't say he wasn't tough later in his career either. But Bob was an interesting guy. He loved Frank Sinatra. Bob had a golf tournament in Newfoundland every year, and he'd bring out certain players and media members, and I was lucky enough to go out. And it was a wild weekend. Bob made sure everybody had a great time, and there wasn't a lot of sleep. And I do remember one an amazing night where I think it was, everybody was winding down, but Bob wasn't, and it was 5 or 5:30 in the morning, and he said, "Get in the car. We're going to Signal Hill to see the sunrise." And he popped a Frank Sinatra tape in the car and started singing, and Bob loves Sinatra. And I've always thought, is there a more iconic Canadian moment than being with Bob Cole on Signal Hill with some Hockey Night in Canada guys watching the sun come up? I guess if he'd have been singing Gordon Lightfoot, it would have been more Canadian, but Bob was a Sinatra guy. And there is a funny Sinatra story I'll tell too, because
yeah, sure.
So Bob idolized Sinatra. I think he saw him a few times, but there was one particular night at the Montreal Forum, and the Canadians had got him a great seat near the stage. And for whatever reason that night, he's on the aisle, and Sinatra left the stage and walked down the aisle where Bob was, and he shook a few hands. And Bob stuck his hand out to acknowledge, you know, one of the great legends of his life. And Sinatra shook his hand and then moved on. And Bob kind of, he hesitated and looked at his hand and then realized that Sinatra was gone, and he didn't have anything to say to him. And I always smile about that story because it's probably the only time that Bob never had the right thing to say at the appropriate moment.
And I'm sure Bob, whether he realized it in real time or not, he was probably on the opposite end of that at times, because I can imagine there would be a lot of people that would say, boy, if I ever got the chance to meet Bob Cole, this is what I tell him and how much I enjoy this and how much I respect what he does. But in the moment, I'm sure there would be a lot of Canadians that would be absolutely starstruck, just like he was meeting Sinatra.
Sure, it was, you know, we worked on the other crew. So as a play-by-play guy, I rarely worked with Bob. And we would always get together at the All-Star game. And so our crew would do the skills, Bob and Harry would do the All-Star game, but we'd have a night together the Thursday or whatever before the weekend began. And I remember one in particular because the Globe and Mail had done this huge takeout on Bob and the legend and whatever. And they had interviewed Scott Russell. And in it, Scott said, you know, Bob can be idiosyncratic. And Bob was, you know, he had his mannerisms and everybody had some fun with some of those mannerisms. But anyway, that got in the article. The article was glowing, as it should be, on Bob and his greatness. So anyway, at the Thursday night, as we all get together, it's almost like a receiving line because we all wanted to acknowledge Bob. We hadn't seen him all year, and he was that special. And we go down the line, and there's Greg Millen, and then I shake his hand. Chris Boy, how you doing? And then Scott got to him, and he literally pulled the hand back for a moment. And he said, Scott, idiosyncratic, what's that all about? So Scott was kind of, he was walking on thin ice there for a short period of time. But Bob did have his foibles, and that was a big reason why we loved him so much.
And is that how he would refer to you, as Chris Boy?
Chris Boy a lot. Chris Boy, you're doing okay. And if you heard that from Bob Cole in my position, that couldn't be a bigger pat on the back. So, and later on, Bob had his own style, and he, you know, one of the most important things for Bob, and it is for me too, is getting the lines. And for Bob, that was all important, and getting those lines from the coaches, and sometimes if I'd done a team before him and he was coming in next, he'd want to know what the lines were. But he usually always went to the coaches, but he seemed to like backup in case the coaches didn't want to provide those lines. And there were a few that didn't when Bob was in his prime, and boy, did that irritate Bob Cole, to the point that I won't mention a guy's name. There was a coach that's in the league right now, and he would not give Bob the lines, you know, even though he was a legendary guy, and everybody else would have respected that, you know, he could give them in private. Bob was certainly not going to give it out to anybody else, but this coach in particular would not, and Bob let him know he wasn't happy about it. And later that coach got fired, and I remember him, remember our stats guy saying that Bob had called him afterwards, the stats guy, and said, well, we've gotten rid of that one. We've only got one more to go. So he actually kept a list of the guys that weren't going to cooperate with him. So.
Oh, those are amazing stories. And that's great insight into the kind of person that Bob Cole was. In terms of his profession, I don't even know where to start there, but in your experience, in your estimation, what made him so iconic on the air as a play-by-play broadcaster?
Well, I think first and foremost, and I want to say voice, but I think passion. The man loved the game. He just had an extraordinary passion, and I think most of us that do it have that, but Bob had a different level of it. Respect for the game, respect for the players, respect for everybody involved in the game. And that Saturday night game was everything for Bob, and nothing was going to get in the way of it being properly done to Bob's highest standards. I think it starts with, and I'll go back because Bob literally, I mean, it's a legendary story. He walked into Foster Hewitt's office with a tape in the 60s just to get Foster Hewitt to critique it. And it's an extraordinary story because Foster Hewitt was the first and almost the only other iconic legend in broadcasting. And he started in what, the late 20s, early 30s. And he heard Bob's tape and kind of gave him the stamp of approval. And very shortly after, Bob was following in Foster's footsteps as the lead voice of Hockey Night in Canada. And it's almost like a 90-year span where it's Foster Hewitt and then Bob Cole with a small interruption. But, that lineage of royalty in hockey broadcasting, that rivals the House of Windsor in my mind. It's pretty remarkable. But for him to, again, just can you imagine you want a job and you go to the top person in that field and the door opens and you get the audience. And, they bonded right away. And so the man that invented the way we do the game really passed the torch in that meeting, and the rest is history.
And I wouldn't pretend to be able to sort of break down exactly what made Bob Cole as great as he was, but as a viewer, it just seemed like there was that voice. There was a certain cadence. The phrasing was wonderful, but it was never too much. And there just seemed, Chris, to be this recognition, the ability to recognize moments within a game and let them breathe and just let the game play out in this way that he was adding to it and never taking away from it.
Yeah, it was his rule. It was not about him. And, we talked a little bit about that, and I've seen him use a similar analogy. We're kind of the artwork's on the ice, we're the frame, and any frame will do, but you want to frame it properly. And nobody framed it better than Bob. And he had that staccato, the right cadence. The voice was, I think it is the greatest voice in the history of hockey broadcasting. But he used it so well, and you're right, the anticipation, he could see the play forming, and he had a nice way of saying it, and I agree with him. I know a lot of play-by-play guys are sticklers for where the broadcast position is, and he had this nice phrase about, I like to be on high. And I think what he was trying to say, not just you don't want to be high, but you want to be high and over the ice. And the Forum in Montreal was absolutely perfect for that. Most of the old buildings were. I think as he got older and we got into newer rinks where we were on the seventh and eighth floors, it wasn't as easy for him to do what he always did. And it wasn't easy for any of us compared to some of the best rinks and best broadcast positions. But he was very particular about that. I think he started in Newfoundland in one of the main rinks in St. John's, literally in the rafters hanging over the ice. And I guess that's, became that familiar way to watch the game and view it. And again, the anticipation, that's probably just your just instincts that you were born with.
Yeah, and you've already shared some wonderful anecdotes and stories and insights, so I hope this isn't putting you on the spot too much, but as you throughout the course of the day today, as you sit and reflect, is there any image or is there any moment that sort of comes to mind when you're, in a quiet moment thinking about your former colleague and friend?
I think about the character he was. I've got to admit, and I hope this isn't taken the wrong way because it was always respectful, but all of us that were around Bob would have our own little bit of a Coley way of phrasing things. We used the phrases the same way. So you know, I was thinking about Saturday and what a daunting task it is to be sitting in the broadcast booth he has made so famous and having to call a game that I know is not going to be in the same level, but you want to respect the way he did it and pay homage to it. And so I was, you know, you're thinking of his different phrases and, you know, everything's happening. And there's some that I won't touch. I would never say, "Oh baby," because I can't say, "Oh baby," like Bob could at the right time. But I just, you know what, I spent almost all day watching old clips of Bob. The respect he had from the players is something I admire. Thinking about Wayne Gretzky, because Wayne thought so highly of Bob and would always call him Mr. Cole and would call him on a regular basis just to make sure everything was well. I heard a story today that Sidney Crosby's phone has Bob for his messages. So Sidney can't come to the phone right now, so it's Bob's voice, which is just amazing. Just thinking about Bob, and if we were really paying homage to him tonight, we'd all have a Captain Morgan dark rum, because Bob liked a rum and coke after the game, but it had to be a certain kind. And when he was on the road in the Stanley Cup playoffs with in the States, where they did not sell his brand, he'd get certain referees to bring him more stock as the playoffs went on to make sure he didn't run out. So lots of thoughts. Just an incredible man and an incredible broadcaster.
Well, Chris, we certainly thank you for sharing, you know, your recollections and your remembrances. I know it's a tough day, but hopefully, you know, the memory of Bob Cole also brings a smile to your face as you kind of go through this. And so thanks for your time, and a great luck with the rest of your playoff run here. I think you're next up on Saturday, right?
Next up on Saturday in Bob Cole's booth at the in the Foster Hewitt press conference, press box in Toronto. So, yes, it's been a nice day to reflect anyway. Certainly a legendary guy, and there'll never be another one like him.
Well, thanks for your time tonight. We appreciate it. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers, Sid. Thank you.
I'm going to talk about highway safety, particularly when it comes to commercial truck drivers. And if you're wondering how far we've come in the training of truck drivers since the Humboldt Broncos bus tragedy in 2018, according to a new survey and a new study, the answer to that question may be not nearly far enough. The survey was commissioned by the Insurance Bureau of Canada. Amanda Dean is vice president for the Ontario and Atlantic regions of the IBC. Amanda, welcome to the program. I guess I just want to start out by asking you, what are the main findings of this report?
Well, there are three key findings from the report: the who's driving, what they're driving, and where they're driving. So let's start with the who. New inexperienced truck drivers are more likely to be involved in accidents. There is a clear correlation between truck driver experience, the amount of training they've received, and the rate and severity of claims that insurers are seeing. In terms of the what the truck is carrying has an impact on liability coverage. Accidents involving heavy loads or dangerous goods tend to be more severe, and as a result, the level of liability coverage a truck requires will increase if the driver is transporting these kinds of goods. And that brings us to the where. Short-range truck drivers have lower risk profiles, whereas trucks with exposure to the U.S. in particular, where we see very high jury verdicts with massive payoffs, is a higher risk. So just imagine if you're a new and experienced driver carrying dangerous goods and driving in the U.S., that's kind of the trifecta. But those are the three main things that the report found.
And some of those seem, I don't want to say common sense, because maybe this really shines a light on some areas that weren't as apparent before, but I think it would make sense to most people if it was explained that, you know, the less experience you have, you know, the more likely you might be to be involved in a collision, the heavier load you're carrying, same thing. And I think people are, you know, fairly up to speed on some of the litigation practices in the United States and how drivers could be vulnerable there. But as I look through this, you also, it seems that, you know, that mandatory entry level training has yet to be implemented across Canada, which I think it's surprising, and not to use just one incident as an example, but I think there are people who look at, you know, the tragedy in Humboldt and think that since then more of these steps would have been put in place. Is that concerning that not every jurisdiction is implementing that?
Well, and it's, you know, to your point as well, that entry-level training is, quite frankly, at this point, not designed to fully prepare drivers for operating heavy trucks in all conditions. When you think about just the variety of weather even that we face within this particular country, these entry-level training programs don't cover the full range of competencies required of drivers, which means that graduating drivers do not yet have that full set of skills required to be on the road. And provinces need to adjust their training programs beyond just the minimum standard. One of the other things that we found interesting as well was that regular one-on-one mentoring and training from experienced drivers can increase the safety of new drivers by reducing errors, things like harsh braking and cornering. So one of the recommendations is that provincial and territorial governments take a look at funding the development and administration of these types of programs, potentially through public-private partnerships. There's a lot of knowledge walking out the door when these experienced drivers retire, ensuring that they're mentoring that next generation of drivers could go a long way.
Is this still too fresh, or has there been any inroads or any progress made along those lines of saying, okay, we're going to give this, you know, if I can call it basic entry level training, and that's the foundation, and then we're going to move on to advanced training or mentorship or training with another driver in the car through certain road conditions. Is that a more long term process, or are you seeing any of that happening right now?
Well, we're seeing the conversations happening right now, and that's a good place to start. Governments are certainly interested because we all know the valuable role that truck drivers play in our society in transporting goods from one point to another and making sure that there's food on the shelves, and, you know, the list could quite frankly go on. So it's a conversation where people are starting to listen. And the reason why we had commissioned this report on behalf of the insurance industry in the first place was that it stemmed from conversations that we had with not only our member companies, but also with trucking companies and their associations. And it started with questions about trucking insurance premiums and how we could work together to reduce premiums. And as insurance is really, when you get down to it, just math, premiums are dictated by the nature of risk. And then for a number of reasons, commercial trucking has become a bit riskier over the past many years. So what we wanted to do with this report was get to the bottom of the problem and see what was driving the elevated risk and what some solutions were. And certainly the trucking companies, as well as the various trucking associations across the country, have been incredibly helpful and supportive as we've gone down this path.
I don't want to get too deep in the weeds when it comes to insurance, because that won't impact a lot of people directly. It will obviously for the people in the industry. But would there be different premium structures based on region or jurisdiction? If you know, for example, that this jurisdiction has been doing a better job of training and then maybe having extended training or mentorship after the fact versus another jurisdiction that it's just a basic mandatory entry-level training and then here are the keys and here's your new job.
Yeah, well, there's a whole host of different variables. So to start off with, every province has a slightly different insurance product that is regulated by the province. So you start with that. Next, in terms of the training, even if truck drivers are not driving into the U.S., they are crossing provincial borders. So it just depends on where the collisions are occurring. Other factors that play into how premiums are calculated include the claims history of the driver, years experience, mitigation strategies in place to ensure that the vehicle is safe to operate, where are they driving? How far are they driving? Are they driving cross country? Are they driving into the U.S.? Are they just sticking within one region of the country, perhaps just as far from, you know, between Alberta and BC, or just within the Atlantic provinces? A whole host of factors come into play when taking a look at insurance premiums for long haul trucking.
Now, you did mention the shortage of truck drivers in Canada, and depending on where you look, I mean, we're told that number could be in the tens of thousands, a shortage of tens of thousands of truck drivers. Does the industries need to fill those positions impact the training that's provided? In other words, is there you know, incentive to fast track and get more people on the road?
There may very well be, and I think that there's opportunity to take a look at the programs that currently exist, how they can be upgraded in the short term, but also planning for some long-term improvements, because one of the things, just from a purely insurance perspective, is that claims drive premiums. If there are more claims, and the amount of claims that occur keep increasing, it stands to reason premiums will follow. And the insurance industry, for its part, we want to be a collaborative partner with the trucking industry in taking a look at what we can do to help make Canada's roads safer, knowing that there are significant challenges related to driver shortages and access to adequate training and risk management. So we're in this conversation for the long term. This is not us just creating a report and then walking away from the issue. We want to be part of the solution. We know that the trucking industry has some specific challenges with recruitment, like many industries do right now. And we just hope that this report serves as a call to action to update and improve training and enforcement standards right across the country.
One of the other issues that the report brought forward was the notion that enforcement of commercial truck regulations violations isn't where it needs to be. Can you give us a little bit more info on that? What was found there exactly?
That it was, quite frankly, a bit inadequate. This is something that certainly needs improvement in terms of quality and consistency. So that would enormously help the entire process. When you take a look at some of the recommendations that are coming out of this report for the training in particular, making sure that the quality is there and the consistency of delivering that training is there, so that truck drivers in Manitoba are just as equally equipped as truck drivers in Quebec. And there is that consistency right across the country. Because again, there's a great likelihood that if you are in the trucking industry, you're driving further than just the borders within the borders of your own province. So that is a really important part as well.
And how is that police these violations? Are these the regular sort of pullover on the side of the road, on the side of the highway that people would be familiar with, or is there more to it than that?
There's a bit more to it than that. And certainly those working within the trucking industry could speak to that far better than I could. But there's a lot of self-regulation as well, and taking a look at what is what rules are being followed in terms of weight, loads, you name it. So there's a lot of work that the associations do at that level as well. But of course, law enforcement play a big role in it, and just a general awareness of what those safety rules are.
And so the Insurance Bureau of Canada commissions a report, you get the findings back, you go through it. What do you have at your disposal to try and force through some of these improvements that you've been talking about here? Is it public pressure, or do you have some control over where we go from here?
What we do have control over is who we're reaching out to and engaging in conversation on this. We're reaching out to governments in provinces right across the country to engage in conversation. We know that these elected officials, who are also the ministers responsible for some of this training, they have constituents who drive trucks, and they hear from those constituents about insurance premiums, in addition to even what they're seeing within their own industry in terms of accidents and collisions. We're hearing about it on the media even. So reaching out, having some conversations with the provinces, putting some of these solutions in front of them. This is not something that's going to be taken off the page and changed tomorrow. However, we want to keep this report fresh, because it can go a long way to improving the environment for the trucking industry. We also want to continue the conversation with the trucking companies and trucking associations that have helped guide us along the way as well. That's an important part of this, and governments will of course want to hear from them as well. This impacts their industry. This is the future of their industry, and it speaks to the training of those who will be leaders within their industry in short order.
And so we've talked a lot about some of the shortcomings in when it comes to training for truck drivers. When you kind of sit back and take a broader view of this, with those shortcomings acknowledged and brought forward in this report, do you think are we in a better position than we were when it comes to this industry 5, 8, 10 years ago? Have we taken a step back, or where are we at on that sort of progress curve?
Well, I think those within the trucking industry could respond to that better than I, because they would know better if there's been a slew of retirements just by virtue of years of service over the past couple of years. Certainly, we've seen in the past little while a number of media articles right across the country about large-scale collisions mm-hmm. in terms of trucks. We've also been seeing it from the insurance industry's perspective in terms of the claims that are coming in. So instead of just doing what the industry does in calculating risk and translating that into premium, the industry wanted to be part of the solution, part of the broader conversation.
Right, and we talk about one particular industry, but of course it impacts all of us, because we all share the road, and it is an important discussion and conversation to bring forward. Amanda, appreciate Absolutely. Your time. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you, Sid. Take care.
All right, now our next guest is Amber Vai. Amber is joining us from British Columbia. She is the mother of Carter Vai. When Carter was 9 years old last year, he died from an asthma attack caused by wildfire smoke. And now Amber is on a mission to help other families learn about air quality and about the dangers of wildfire smoke. Amber, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today.
Yeah, of course.
And obviously, deepest condolences on the passing of your son. What kind of a child was Carter?
Carter was an incredible kid. He was the life of the party. He was everybody's friend. Whether you were 2 years old or you were 80 years old, he would find common ground. He was just a really incredible kid, always smiling, always happy, always wanting to have a good time. He loved music. He loved soccer. He was a pretty amazing little guy.
There's nothing better than a young child who can relate to older people, whether it's their grandparents or their neighbors. There's something special about those. And a lot of kids do, but not every kid. But there's something special about that kid that kind of just takes to everybody, isn't there? And it sounds like that's the kind of person Carter was.
Yeah, he definitely was that kid that just, he liked everybody, and he was willing to be friends with anyone that wanted to be friends with him. Always the kid that stood up for everybody else. So yeah, he was pretty amazing.
Did he have favorite activities or things that he liked to do?
He really loved to play soccer. He loved music. He knew the words to every song, inappropriate or not. he loved to dance. He, whenever we would have family over and be playing music, he would always be the one in the living room dancing with everybody. He was full of life, and he loved hanging out with his siblings and doing anything that they were doing.
Can you take us back then? And I want to talk about Carter's Project and what you're doing to kind of raise awareness, to kind of prevent these sorts of tragedies in the future. But before we get there, can you take us back to last year and just kind of walk us through what happened?
Yeah. On the day that Carter passed away, he came with me. I was running the summer camp at our local arena, and he came with me that day. He was super excited because we were going to the park and going to go to the water park, and we were going to play soccer, have a picnic, and he was crazy excited about it. That morning, he got all his stuff together, his puffer bag that he always carried around with him, his sunscreen and towel and all his extra clothes and everything, and we packed lunches and stuff, and we went off to summer camp, and before we left the camp, we checked the air quality, not knowing that it was coming from Williams Lake, which is almost 100 kilometers away from us. And it was at about a 2, I think. So we figured, okay, it's okay for the kids to walk to the park. You couldn't smell the smoke. You couldn't see smoke. Right. So we got everybody ready and we walked to the park. It's about a 10-minute walk from the arena. And we spent the afternoon there just having a great time. And it was around 12 or 12:30 that we started noticing the smoke coming in. So I had someone from the camp come to the park with her vehicle and pick him up just so that he didn't have to walk back in the heat and the smoke. And so I walked back with the rest of the kids. When we got back, Carter was so excited. The first thing he said to me was, "Mom, we have to go get Slurpees today." And I was like, "Okay, buddy, yeah, we can probably do that." And he's like, "No, I heard on the radio, it's free Slurpee day. We have to go get Slurpees." So we decided that we would go and get Slurpees after dinner with the whole family, which unfortunately we never made it to. But we continued on the rest of our afternoon at camp. We kept the kids inside and they played dodgeball and did crafts and everything. And Carter was great. We went to the grocery store after camp. We went and picked my husband up from work. And he was like talkative and super excited to go get Slurpees and just to go and talk to his siblings because they had stayed home that day. And just, he was really excited. When we got home and I was getting everything ready for dinner, he started coughing like crazy. And so we gave him his puffer, and this persisted. So we gave him his puffer a couple more times and another puffer that he had. And he finally seemed like it was kind of subsiding a bit, but he was so hot and worked up from coughing for so long. So we put him in a cool bath and I was sitting beside the tub with him and talking. And then he started coughing like crazy again. And I knew at that point we needed to take him in. It wasn't uncommon for Carter to have to go into the hospital a couple times a year to get oxygen if he had a cold or something had happened. So we made the decision to put him in the truck and drive him in, because the week prior to that, his older sister had an accident and passed out, and it took the ambulance 12 minutes to get to our house, and we knew that Carter needed to get there now. So I called 911 as soon as I left the driveway, and I got him to the hospital in less than 5 minutes, and the paramedics were waiting outside the door, and I pulled the truck right up to the front to the front door, and they grabbed him out of there and immediately took him in. And even up until the point, like, I watched them work on him for what seemed like a lifetime. And even when the doctor pulled us away to tell us there was nothing more that they could do, I still, in that moment, still thought there was something that he was going to say. We could these are the two options we have. I never in a million years thought we would be leaving the hospital that night without him.
Oh boy. And then this was traced to, I mean, obviously, as you detailed, your son had asthma and you're well aware of that and you've got the puffers. But it was brought on, they determined, by this wildfire smoke. Was there indications? I know you said you had the air quality monitor, but it happened to be, you know, the monitor itself was 100 kilometers or so away, far away from where you were. Before the coughing fit came on, were there indications? Was there the smell in the air? Was visibility an issue? Or was there any indication that the smoke or the air quality might lead to something like this?
By that time of the night, you could smell the smoke. And I mean, if the smoke started to come in like around 12 or 1230, which is why I got him back to camp and inside. So he wasn't out in the smoke. Up until the point of having to take him to the hospital, just shortly before that, when he started to have an asthma attack, there was no indication. He wasn't wheezy that day, nothing. Like, he had to use his puffer, I think, once or twice when he was running around at the park, which wasn't uncommon for him in the heat, in like just doing physical activity. He often had to use his puffer, but I had no indication, not a thought in my mind that was going to be his last day.
And our guest is Amber Vi. Amber's 9-year-old son, Carter, died last year from an asthma attack caused by wildfire smoke. And now Amber and her family are on a mission to help other families learn about air quality and the dangers of wildfire smoke. And Amber, this comes in the form of Carter's Project. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so we started Carter's Project alongside the BC Lung Foundation just shortly after Carter passed away. And what we're doing is bringing air quality monitors into those towns across BC that don't have accurate and real-time air quality monitoring system. We are starting in 100 Mile House where we live, and we're actually bringing the monitors 200 Mile on May 14th. People they were able to go online and apply for the monitors. I have been told that we actually had 102 applications, so there will be 102 monitors coming into 100 Mile. 10 of those monitors are outdoor monitors, which you'll be able to go online and check the location for each of the monitors, to see what the air quality is in that specific area. And with Carter's Project, we're also going to bring that education surrounding asthma and the dangers of air quality, both inside your house and outside of your house. And yeah, just hoping to prevent kids from going through the same thing that Carter went through, and families going through the same thing we're going through, just to bring that awareness a little bit more out there to help people understand, like, that asthma can go from 0 to 100 in the blink of an eye, and you weren't even expecting it, but all of a sudden it's catastrophic.
And I think that's probably the key, because if you're a parent of a child with asthma, you kind of know what it's all about. You take certain precautions, you monitor, and yet even with all of those steps, the air quality can cause something to come on so fast, so unexpectedly, and with such devastating consequences. Is there a takeaway that you would like families to take away from a conversation like this, from the things that you're attempting to do through Carter's Project?
I think it's just really important that people are aware of the air quality levels and aware of where that air quality information is coming from. I personally had no idea that by looking on my phone, on my weather app, that information was coming from so far away. And there's so many places across BC and across Canada that don't have that accurate monitoring rate for their area. even in 100 mile, from one side of 100 mile to the other, geographically, it's so different. And the air quality is so different in every different area that I think it's so important for people to really pay attention to that. It may be the middle of wildfire season and you can't see the smoke, but there's still fine particulates in the air that are going to wreak havoc on those people that have asthma or other lung diseases. So I think it's just really important that we pay attention and get that knowledge, to find out how you can help yourself and help others.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think particularly the last few years have been so bad for forest fires. Fires are already starting up and we're not even into the month of May yet. And that seems like it's from the experts, from what they tell us, that's going to be the norm moving forward here. And we kind of get conditioned that we just kind of maybe even as individuals poke our head outside and go, okay, well, it doesn't seem that bad today. It was worse yesterday and we were able to get through it. But, we might be, taking some really big chances here that we ought not to be taking, particularly when we have family members that might be susceptible. So doing great work, and the response you're getting is good?
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing. We have a lot of events coming up over the summer, and we're just raising as much money as we can so that we can go to as many places as we possibly can. I would love to see Carter's Project go straight across the country and help people everywhere. And we've said it right from the beginning that Carter was the kid that would have made a difference in this world had he have been given the opportunity. And I'm so proud that we're able to do this in his name and make a difference for him. And I know he's proud of us.
I'm sure he is, Amber. He sounds like a wonderful child, and it's wonderful work that you're doing in his name. Thank you for spending some time with us this evening. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.